nanohub.org. You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Enjoy the show.
So today I'd like to start a new topic, spin. Although, as I mentioned before, as far as understanding current flow through small devices is concerned, the basic equations, what you have, I mean, I won't be adding much to it really. Yeah. That's it. And it's really now a matter of applying it to different things. And spin is a very good example of this. That, you know, we had talked about, in January, we were talking about this semi-classical transport, where I said that you could think of electrons, you do not worry about the wave nature of electrons, and it's almost the flow of electrons. You could understand almost in terms of how cars go on a highway. I mean, there's not that much difference, really. That's the semi-classical view. But then electrons also have this wave-like properties, which gives rise to interference, which you miss in the semi-classical picture. But then, because there's always a lot of dephasing processes, often these interference effects don't really show up in any measurements at room temperature. Although in small devices, it can be important. And so we spent much of February, actually, talking about quantum transport, right? And in quantum transport, in terms of the math, what happens is every quantity, like, say, electron density, that in the semi-classical picture, you know, if you had a device with, say, 3 points, then you'd think, when I talk about electron density at a given energy, I'd have to tell you three things. What's the electron density here? What's the electron density there? What's the electron density there? Whereas, when you want the quantum description, the thing is, instead of electron density, you have this correlation function, you know, this G super N, which is actually a 3x3 matrix. So although we have 3 points, now I actually have to tell you 9 things, you know, that entire 3x3 matrix. Why? Because I have to tell you not only electron density here, here, and here, but also the phase relationship of the wave function between this point and that point, which is like the 1-2 element of that matrix, and then the 1-3 element of that matrix, and so on. And that information under certain conditions can be important. On the other hand, if you have a lot of dephasing, as I mentioned, most of the time, electrons going through solid is like, you know, having light go through a very turbulent medium. So there's all this jiggling around that's happening, and which destroys a lot of the phase information often. And which is why often you can neglect the off-diagonal terms and get a description that's a lot like the semi-classical picture that we did in January. Okay? So those are two pictures to kind of keep in mind. And spin is a very good example which embodies both of these, that there are many things you can understand just within a semi-classical thing, and there are some things you cannot. See? Now, in terms of the math, if I had to tell you, that, well, how do we include spin into our calculations? Like what you've been doing the last few homeworks, for example, you've been calculating using this quantum general method for calculating current through a 1D device, and the last homework you even had something that was a two-dimensional conductor and so on. Now, what would you do if you had to include spin in it? And I'd say that, you know, formally all that happens is every matrix just gets twice as big. Formally, that's about it. Equations are all the same. Now, the way you visualize it is as if, you know, you had 3 points, and now as if you got 3 more points, and that's like your upspin channel, and that's like your downspin channel, sort of. So it's like at every point, you got 2 components, an upspin and a downspin. Upspin and a downspin. That's it. So what you could do with 3x3 matrices, now you have to do it with 6x6. So formally, that's it, in a way. But as I've often said, you know, calculating something and then understanding something are two different things. And so what I'll be trying to explain to you is the physics behind it, what it leads to, what kind of experimental observations one tries to understand on these terms, which things you can understand without, like when I add another point, you think that instead of one element that tells you the electron density here, you'll now need two. But then in the quantum description, you actually need four. You see? And the question is, when do you need four? What can you understand with two? Well, and these things, you know, clarify some of the very basic issues of this quantum mechanics and the, you know, the quantum picture and the semi-classical picture. So just to get started then, let's start with the simplest device, you see, where you just have one point, you know, like a device with one level, you know, something very small. Well, I mean, of course, you always have many levels, but then you have only one level, let's say, in the region of interest, in that energy range of interest. Everything else is somewhere down here or somewhere up there, doesn't really matter as far as current flow goes. So there's just one level. Now, one thing we discussed is one level, you could take again the equations we have discussed. Every matrix is just a 1x1 matrix. One of your homework problems, I think you worked out what the current would be. And it would be something like, you know, if I assume the rate at which electrons go in and out here is gamma 1, the rate at which it goes in and out here would be gamma 2. What you can show is that the current voltage characteristics of a device like this would look like so when I put a voltage on this, at first no current will flow, and then when the chemical potential crosses this level, so that the level lies between two chemical potentials, that's when a current will start flowing. And the maximum current that you can get through a level, that maximum value, that's Q over H bar. This is a thing in what was one of your homework problems. It's a simple thing you can understand easily. Gamma 1 is the rate at which it comes in and out from here. Gamma 2 is the rate at which it comes in and out from the other contact. The two things are in series, so it's like adding two conductances in series, in a way. Like G1, G2 over G1 plus G2, essentially. That's what it amounts to. Okay. Now, question is, what does spin do to this? So, well, spin, basically all that happens is, there's another level here. So, you had an up spin, now you have a down spin. So, previously, you had one point, now you'll have two points. And the thing is, the two are identical in all respects. So it is sort of like if I'm doing this mathematically, previously my H was just a 1x1 matrix, which had the energy of this level, you know, epsilon. Now, H will look like epsilon, 0, 0, epsilon. Now, two degenerate levels, both had epsilon, whatever that number. Now I've got 2x2 matrices. So if I had to write the coupling to the two contacts, previously I might have written it as sigma, you know, sigma 1. Actually, it's just one level, sigma 1 and sigma 2 are much the same. So previously we were writing it as minus I gamma 1 over 2. That's what it was before. Now it will be another gamma 1 over 2 here. I guess I'll write the 2 out here. And then if you want sigma 2, there will be a 2 there. I mean, instead of gamma 1, I'll have gamma 2. Good. So what will happen is, if you use this to do that same problem, and at the end of the day, you have to take a trace. And basically, all you have is two identical channels which are uncoupled. So you can go through the math. You'll get much the same answer, except that you'll have a 2 in front. And as you know, throughout this course so far, I've been just putting in the 2 at the end. You know, and sometimes I forget to add it in, but you know, basic idea is, and you just do whatever you want to do with one spin, multiply by 2. And that works fine as long as all you have is two independent channels, no particular difference between them. Okay? So how do you see a difference? You know, what kind of devices would actually show you some difference between the two spins where you, you know, can't just add in a 2? Now, a very good example of that, which is one that, you know, nowadays, you know, is finding real practical applications also, is this magnetoresistance device. You know, I think started with something called the GMR effect, they called it the giant magnetoresistance. And at that time, what they called giant was really a relatively small effect, you know, less than 10%, more like 1 or 2%. And over the years, it has improved. And now they have something called TMR, this tunneling magnetoresistance, which is actually, they talk about things like 100%, 200% effects. It's very big numbers now. And it's used as a way of detecting magnetic fields. That is, information is often stored in the form of magnetic bits. And what you want is something that will sense the magnetic field due to that. And these devices have the property that in a magnetic field, their resistance changes quite a bit. That's what you call magnetoresistance. That's in a magnetic field, the resistance changes. And if that's large, you call it giant, etc. And that then allows you to detect whether the bit is up or down, and whether the magnet is where it's magnetized. Okay? That's the idea. So now the way that device works, in the simplest way you can understand the principle, is that you are using 2 magnets as your contacts. So as far as the device is concerned, that's a non-magnetic thing like anything else that we have discussed. No difference. What's different about it is, I've got a magnet that's polarized up and a magnet that's magnetized down. Or down or up, one of those. So actually, I'll pull it both ways. And this, what happens when you put it in a magnetic field is that once the magnetic field crosses some value, one of this magnet flips. And this giant magnetoresistance is because the resistance of this device is different depending on whether the 2 magnets are parallel or anti-parallel. So people talk about what is the parallel resistance and what is the anti-parallel resistance. And there's a difference between them. Now, you might say, well, when I put a magnetic field, won't both magnets flip? Well, eventually, yes. What they do is they make the magnet slightly different. That is, something about the geometry is a little bit different so that one of them flips at a lower field than the other. And so as you raise the magnetic field, so let's say they're both pointing this way, and you turn up a magnetic field in this direction. So as you raise the magnetic field, at some point, one of these flips. Now, a little later, when you increase it even more, both will flip. But the point is, you adjust the thresholds in such a way that the point at which one of them flips, that you can detect. Because that's the point where these 2 resistances will be different. After that, you are again back to R parallel. So you start parallel, become anti-parallel, and then eventually it's all back parallel, back to parallel again. Okay? But it's those changes that are detected, usually. Okay. Now, question is, how do you understand why the resistance is a little different when it's parallel or anti-parallel? Okay? So in these terms, I'd say you could have a pretty straightforward, simple model. The way I'd say it is that what these magnets do is, it makes it a little easier for one type of spin to get out than the other type of spin. That is, ordinarily what would have happened is, whether I talk about the up spin or the down spin inside my device, they can both get out at a certain rate, say gamma 2. Now what we'll say is, well, one spin can get out a little differently from the other spin. So I'll call one of them alpha and one of them beta. And let's say alpha is greater than beta. So which one will be bigger? The idea is that inside the magnet, what happens is upspin and downspin have different density of states. That's the thing that's different. ordinarily in any material, if you plot the density of states in any material, any normal non-magnetic material, you'll see some density of states like this that we draw, and up and down are right on top of each other. You know, half the density of states that you see is due to ups, the other half is due to downs. So just add. Okay. But in a magnet, the thing is, those two are different. In a magnet, if I actually were drawing the density of states, it might look, say, something like this. So this is for up, and let's say this is for down. So a little bit different for the two. And so what that means is, of course, what matters is the density of states that you have right around the chemical potential, wherever the electron is trying to get out, at the energy that electron is trying to get out. And you could have a situation, for example, if the mu was here, I mean, the electron was trying to get out at this energy, then what would happen, you can see, is the upspin would have lots of states to jump out into, and the downspin can't find a state to get out at all. So you then have an ideal situation, which, you know, is what people would really like, and that is a really polarizing contact that lets one type of spin get out and completely blocks the other one. That's what they would really like. In practice, what they get is much less, but there is a significant difference, and enough that it gives you measurable effects. What they really like to do is have a 100% discrimination. Okay. Anyways, but because of this, because the density of states is different for up and for down, what happens in this picture then is that when the upspins are, when the majority carrier is going out, it has a different escape rate from the minority carrier. You know, majority and minority, I don't mean in the sense of electrons and holes or the sense you usually see in semiconductor devices. What I mean is, if you have a magnet, you know, magnetized in this direction, if the spin is along the magnet, that's one, and if the spin is anti-parallel in the other direction, we call it, that's the other one. So that's what I mean by majority and minority. And one of them is alpha, the other is beta. One of them gets out very easily because there's a high density of states. Another one has a hard time getting out because it has a low density of states in the contact. Okay. Now the point is that if both magnets happen to be parallel, then the way you'll have it is that for this level, the rate at which it escapes is alpha, and the rate at which it escapes this way is also alpha. And similarly for this one, it's beta in either direction. So this would be the parallel configuration. Why? Because if the upspin is a majority carrier in this contact, it's also a majority carrier in that contact, because they're parallel magnets. So you got alpha, alpha, beta, beta. So now if I calculate the current, what we'll get is, I won't have this 2 here. That 2 was, of course, because you said both spins are identical. Now both spins are different, so I can't just multiply by 2. I have to treat them separately. And the thing is, what I'll have is one spin channel for which gamma 1 and gamma 2 are each equal to alpha, and another one for which they're each equal to beta. So what we have then is Q over H bar, alpha squared over 2 alpha plus beta squared over 2 beta. Which you could write as so that would be a simple theory of that. Now, so this is the parallel case. Put a parallel here. Now, what about the anti-parallel case? So what should we do here? Right, so because now you see we have turned this magnet around. One of them is in the opposite direction. So now what happens is, if you consider a particular spin, if it's a majority carrier going this way, on this direction it's like the minority spin, you see? So if it's alpha here, it will be beta there. And if it's beta here, it will be alpha there. That's the thing. So instead of having two alphas and two betas, you'll now have alpha beta and beta alpha. Okay. So when I calculate this, what I'll find is Q over H bar, alpha beta over alpha plus beta. That's for the up spin, let's say. And for the other spin also, it's the same thing. It's just beta alpha over beta plus alpha. Same thing, so I can just multiply with 2. That's it. So that's kind of like what you expect for current in the parallel configuration. This is the anti-parallel one. So what's the ratio of the two currents? You want to take, say, P over IAP. Can you help me? Alpha plus beta squared, 4 alpha beta. And I think the way people usually define magnetoresistance, you know, there are different ways of doing it, but one they do is they look at the difference, that is parallel minus antiparallel, and I think divided by the antiparallel. I mean, you could have taken parallel minus antiparallel and divided by parallel plus antiparallel, but I think the way they usually do it is just what I said, so which is I subtract 1 from here. So that would make it, I think, IP minus IAP over IAP, let's say. So how much is that? Right, because you see, this minus this is just alpha minus beta square. So just a little algebra and you can write it as this. So one thing you see right away is that this is always a positive quantity. Right? So what that means is parallel current is always greater than anti-parallel current. That's a square. That's always parallel. And of course, if alpha and beta were equal, there would be no effect at all. And also you can see that if you really had a great contact where, you know, really spin polarized contact where beta was zero, so that one type of spin gets out and the other type doesn't get out at all, beta was zero, then this ratio would be infinite. So the way this magnetoresistance is defined, you see, you know, you often hear about 200% magnetoresistance and you wonder what 200% means. The thing is, this, the way it is defined, could actually be infinity in principle, because if beta were zero, it would be enormous. Anyway, so this is just a simple way to see why parallel and anti-parallel could be different. And of course, I took a very simple case where you have a one-level device and you're conducting through it. Now, there are, as I said, many different types of these devices. Some of these are, like, say, the GMR devices consist of all metals. So it would be something like a non-magnetic metal in between, I think something like copper, I believe, and then a magnetic contact, you know, which could be iron, cobalt, some magnetic contacts here. But it's all metal, that's the thing. That's the original GMR devices. You know, this was, I think, first demonstrated around 1988 or so, and that's what got was awarded the Nobel Prize in 2007, I believe, a couple of years back. So that was the original effect, which, as I said, is called giant magnetoresistance. But if you actually look at the numbers, Again, we are talking of 5% or so. I forget the number, possibly even less. But then what's nowadays used a lot, is getting a lot of attention, is what's called tunneling magnetoresistance, where you have magnetic contacts, but in between it's not another metal, but it's a tunneling oxide, something like magnesium oxide or aluminum oxide. So it actually tunnels through this. But the basic effect is coming from the fact that, from the contacts. The fact that these contacts, in one case it's like alpha, beta, and the other case it's like alpha, alpha. That's the basic thing, really. And the details are different. But as I say, the TMRs give you enormous magnetoresistances. I mean, these days people are talking of 100% and more. Actually, it's a fairly, very substantial number. Okay. Now, but basically, this is it, although, as I said, the details will change depending on which device one is talking about. In many of these all-metal devices, the way you think of it is, think of it as if it's a resistance here, and then there's a resistance here, and a resistance here. You know, previously we talked about how you can, in any device, think of a device, resistance for the channel itself, and a resistance for the interfaces. And you could say that in devices like this, what is happening is you have a different resistance for majority carriers and majority spins and a different resistance for minority spins at the interface. And you can, in terms of that, you can analyze it. Because, you know, what I did here, the alphas and betas are sort of like inverse resistances, are kind of playing the role of conductance, really. So you could have written resistances in series and parallel, in series, and come up with much the same kind of results, yeah. Right, dimensionality here has to be less than what you call the spin coherence length. That is, when a spin comes in from here, let's say an up spin comes in. Now, if you make it a very long device, then by the time it comes out here, it has no memory of what it started out as. And then you wouldn't really have an effect. So the basic thing is it has to be less than the spin coherence length. And spin coherence lengths, though, however, especially at low temperatures, can be quite long. Even at room temperature, in short devices, it is longer than that. And TMR, of course, because we are talking of tunneling devices, this is really, nanometers. It's an oxide that you can tunnel through. So coherence isn't quite an issue. It's just the nanometer or two, really. That's what you're talking about. Whereas the original ones were longer, but the thing is it's still shorter than a spin coherence length. Yes?
Does the spin coherence length mean that two channels interact with one another in some way, or in general, can we assume that they do not interact, or do they interact in very long
time? Yeah, interact in the sense of that if you put in a spin here, let's say up spin, there are processes inside that want to turn it into a down spin. So that is what you'd call a spin flip scattering. Right? Something that takes you from one channel into another. And so in that sense, again, if you're thinking in terms of cars on a highway, it's like two lanes, can you cross over from one lane to the other or not? That's about it, right? So, yeah, I'm not sure if I'd call that interaction, but yes, the thing is you can flip from one to the other. Right, so that has to either come through a cross element in the Hamiltonian, like something here, or it could come through a cross element in the scattering term. As you know, we have sometimes talked about putting a sigma S that represents scattering processes. So that one could have something that flips your spin. Okay, so this, as I said, so this is an example of something that you could understand fairly well within a semi-classical picture. You see, the point I'm trying to make is spins embody both these things. There is some things you can understand with just as just two lanes on a highway. You got an up spin lane and a down spin lane. That's about it. And then you can keep track of how things are coming in, going out, and you can understand. But there are things that you cannot, and that's the part I want to go on to. And now one example of that, though, even in this context you can see is, you could ask, what would happen if the two magnets, instead of being parallel or anti-parallel, were like perpendicular? What I mean by that is, if instead of this, let's say the magnet was magnetized in that direction, for example. You know, parallel anti-parallel was kind of easy. I just said, well, alpha alpha beta beta, and in the other case it's alpha beta, right? But what does it mean if a magnet is like that? Now, this is where we need to get a little deeper into what exactly the spin means. So the best way I've seen, the best analogy I've seen for understanding spin in terms of something you have heard of before is the polarization of light or photons. You know, one thing you have heard, I'm sure, is that light, if it's propagating in a certain direction, can have two polarizations. That's the direction of the electric field that you associate with the photon, and it can be, say, X or Y, if you're propagating in the Z direction. Right? And upspin and downspin also you could view as kind of a polarization of the electron. So in that sense, you could think of an experiment like this in terms of an experiment on light, where what you do is, you have a polarizer here, let's say, which makes light, say, come in with its electric field in the Z direction. And then when you're trying to get out here, if you have a analyzer which is also in the same direction, so I call this polarizer, that's the analyzer, then what will happen is lots of light will get through. Because from here, whatever is coming in, then only the Z polarized part is filtered out. Anything that's perpendicular, let me call that X. So let's say this is the Y direction, that's Z, and X is perpendicular to the blackboard. So any X polarization is filtered out. So all that gets through is the Z polarization, and then it just comes out. On the other hand, you see, if the analyzer were polarized in the X direction, you know, coming out of the blackboard, let's say, in the X direction, so the analyzer were actually pointing this way, then it would completely block the light, and you wouldn't get much out of it. Okay? And this is, of course, the basis for lots of optical devices. You know, there's something called an electro-optic modulator, which works like this. That you have a polarizer and you have an analyzer, and in between, you have a material where by putting an electric field on it, you can change its refractive index in such a way that a light with a given polarization rotates as it goes through the material. You see? And so you can switch off the light or you can let a lot of it go through. Let's say and that's a very important device that's used for fast switching of light all the time, right? The electro-optic modulators. Okay. Now this one also you could kind of think of that way. That as if you have a polarizer here and an analyzer here. So one magnet that points up. And so this is the polarizer and this is the analyzer. And if they're both parallel, you got lots of current through it. That's like having a polarizer and an analyzer in the same direction. But then if they're orthogonal, then you don't get much light out of it. Now, if you think of it this way, you right away kind of see there is a little difference, and it's a very important one, between the light polarization and this spin. Light polarization, you know, you have heard of before, you think of it in terms of vectors. You have electric field that's a vector pointing in a certain way. Okay. Now, here, in order to block the light, I'd have to turn the analyzer by 90 degrees. What would happen if I turned it by 180 degrees? It would go through again, right? Because if it's 180 degrees, if it's turned this way, that doesn't matter. That will just go through. It has to be 90 degrees to block it. Right? Here, though, this polarizer is this way. To block it, actually, you have to turn it by 180 degrees. Anti-parallel, that's what blocks it. And then if you went 360 degrees, of course, it would go right through again. So the thing between spin and these vectors, that's the difference, actually. That there is as if turning a vector by 90 degrees is kind of like turning a spin by 180 degrees. See? And so the math is a little bit different. And so let me just state the basic difference quickly, and then we'll go on and see how it comes about, what it means, etc. So here, let's say I've got this thing in the zx plane, and if I had to write the components of the vector in the zx, in znx, you would have written the components as cosine theta and sine theta. On the other hand, when you are talking about a spin, and you are trying to write its components, the up component and the down component. Let me write this up here. So I have this. So for a vector, you would write cosine theta, sine theta. For the up component and the down component of a spinor, it is cosine half theta and sine half theta. Those are the two components of the spinor. Okay. Now, I've tried to make this simple by keeping it in the zx plane. But in general, as you know, things could be pointing in any arbitrary direction. It could have a y component to it, right? So there could be a like a phi then. In that case, if I had to write this here, what would happen is, you do sine theta and then you put a cosine phi if actually it had some amount of y component too. And then the y component would be sine theta sine phi. So that's what you learn when you learn vectors. That a vector pointing in a direction theta comma phi, it has components cosine theta, sine theta cosine phi, and sine theta sine phi. That's what you usually learn. Okay, so what about spinors? Well, now it's got only two components still. You see, it's up and down, that's it. But this cosine theta over 2, you add e to the power minus I phi over 2 and e to the power plus I phi over 2. I guess I ran out of space to write the y component. So let me just write it on top. So whenever you think of a spin, again, you're thinking of it mentally just like a vector, that it's something that points in some direction, right? But then how do I write its components? Well, if it was a vector, I'd have written three components, three real numbers. If it's a spinor and I'm trying to write its components, I got two components, but then the two components are both complex. You see? Now, so when you do the math, usually, you're using these things. On the other hand, when you mentally visualize it, you visualize it as pointing it as in some direction. You write this, but you think of something pointing in some theta and phi direction. Okay? That's the... And that's the thing that you have to kind of get used to, because what you got used to in somewhere in freshman or earlier years is the vector components. That when you point in some direction, well, these are the components of the vector. And the thing is, what you need to get used to is these are the components of a spinor pointing in a certain direction. Okay. Now, this, of course, is not meant to be obvious at all. Right? I'm just stating that bottom line in a way. And what I'll try to do in this lecture and the next one is, I'll try to show you that if you accept this, then how it works. Based on this, how you understand what is experimentally observed, how you model devices, etc. And then I think I'll also come back and try to justify where this comes from. But one thing I meant to say up front is, if you accept this, then everything else follows logically from here. If you accept this one. But then, I'll justify this better a little later. So you'll see also where it comes from. Okay. So if you accept that, then the way it will work is something like this. So, you know, I started to say, how do I analyze a device that has a one magnet pointing in the Z direction, let's say, and the other magnet pointing in the X direction, you know, magnetized in the X direction. And I guess the X direction means coming out of the blackboard. This is Y. So let's say one magnet is this one, the other magnet is perpendicular. In a practical device, no good reason to do it. I mean, as I said, parallel and anti-parallel, that's what gives you the maximum magneto resistance. That's how those devices operate. Okay? It's just that there are other effects in other devices. And to understand those, it is important to have a clear, know how to do this in general. Okay. Now, the way I would do it is, again, in terms of matrices, the way it would work is, and as I said, this also illustrates this last thing that we had been talking about, and that has to do with basis functions, that concept. It all ties into that also. So the way it would work is the following. Okay, if this magnet, instead of pointing in the X direction, let's say we are pointing in the Z direction, then the way I'd have written, say, sigma, you know, one or two, I mean, we are trying to write the sigma associated with this contact. The way I'd have written it is alpha, beta, 0, 0. Right? It's alpha for upspins, beta for downspins, and we just write this. Done. That's it. If it was in this direction. Now the question is, how do I write sigma if the magnet happens to be pointing in the X direction? This way. And my answer is, well, if you use up and down along the X direction, which I'll write this way, as my basis, then it will still look like alpha and beta. Because what it now means is that a majority carrier can always still get out at a rate alpha, but majority carrier means now something that points in the X direction. I guess X was this one. So that's what I'm writing here like this. So what I mean is, if I use X, plus X and minus X, so this represents a up X and a down X, you know, minus, plus X, minus X. If I use this as my basis, it will look exactly the same. Okay? But then, I really want to work with that one. Something that has up and down as the, I'm sorry, I want to work with a basis which is, I want to get this in this basis which is Z up and Z down. That's the basis I want to work in. So question is, how do I turn it into that one? Okay, that's a basis transformation then. That is, what I need to do is put two matrices here, V and V dagger, one of which takes me from up down in the X direction to up down in the Z direction. And here also what I need is something like this. You know, the way I remember, as I've always said, is this must match that. This must match that by the rules of matrix multiplication. And what I need is these two matrices on the two sides. So this matrix tells me what a upspin along Z. Remember, when I draw it vertically, I mean Z. When I draw it horizontally, I mean X. So question is, what an upspin Z looks like in terms of the X's? And this one means what an upspin X looks like in terms of Z's. Okay? So now this one, you could write down based on the information I gave you earlier, although I didn't justify it, I just asked you to accept it. But if you accept this, you know, this up and down is like in the Z direction. This is plus Z and minus Z. And the components are for if you are talking about an upspin in the x direction, you see we have phi equal to 0, theta equal to 90 degrees. So this will be cosine 45 degrees, which will be 1, sine 45 degrees, which is, I guess it's 1 over root 2, so it will be this. So an upspin pointing along x direction will have components 1, 1. So you'll have this one I'd write as 1, 1, and then with a 1 over root 2 in front. I'm pulling it up. And actually, if you looked at the negative x, it would be 1 and minus 1. Now, if you want to write this one, this matrix here, as I've often mentioned, that because these are what you call unitary transformations, you know, the general similarity transformation, what happens is this is supposed to be the inverse of that, you know, this the general transformation, whereas with unitary transformations, inverse is the same as conjugate transpose. So the matrix there is always the conjugate transpose of this. So what I can do, and here it's all real in this case, so it's basically just the transpose. So we can just write 1, 1. It just happens to be the same matrix. In general, it need not be, which is why in general you have to worry about which you write here and which you write there. But in this case, it happens to be the same. But if you do that, then let's do this multiplication. You can work it out quickly. What does this give me? So alpha times 1 plus 0. Alpha plus 0. Beta. And then minus beta. And then I have to multiply this with, I still have to do one more multiplication. And so if you do that, I think you'll get alpha plus beta, hope I got that right, but so the bottom line of this is, well, remember what we were trying to do is write these matrices that describe this coupling to the contact. Because, as I said, the equations, once you have written the matrices, it's the same equations after that for calculating current, whatever it is. The point is to write that matrix. And what we are saying is, well, if we had the magnet in the z direction, it would have been easy. Plus z, minus z, one of them is in the has an escape rate of alpha, another has an escape rate of beta. That's easy enough. You just put it there. Now, what if the magnet is pointing in the x direction? Well, the point is, if you use the x as your basis, up and down in the x direction as your basis, then it would have looked exactly the same, alpha, beta, 0, 0. Because plus x spins can get out very easily, minus x spins don't get out quite so easily. That's easy enough. But what I want is, I want the answer in terms of my plus z and minus z basis, because the rest of the problem may be in that basis. You know, all matrices must be in the same basis. So how do I transform? Well, I have to put these two matrices in front and back. And if I do that, I'd end up with, you know, with some matrix, you'll end up with a matrix looking like this. So the point is then, the sigma for this particular contact will actually end up looking non-diagonal. You'll have alpha plus beta on the diagonal, and you'll actually have something different here. Now, of course, if alpha were equal to beta, that's in that case, it's an unpolarized contact. Then it doesn't matter what transforms you do. The off-diagonal elements will still be 0. But that's because, you see, you're starting with an identity matrix, and then you can transform all you want. It will remain an identity. Okay? But if you start with something like this, then depending on which way the magnet is pointing, you'll get a different answer. So, formally then, that's it, really. That given any two magnets, whatever it is, you can write down the sigmas, because you could always write down the sigma using the basis appropriate for that magnet, and then transform it to a common basis. That's it. But for transforming, of course, you need to know this. So what we'll talk about on Friday is this Handley effect, which is a very interesting effect, and that is, in a device like this, you can see, you can expect that if you rotated this magnet, the current would keep oscillating because sometimes it would be maximum, sometimes it would be minimum. Now, rotating the contact isn't so easy. What they usually do is they, if you put a magnetic field inside, then the spin itself rotates as it goes through the device. And that gives rise to an oscillating current. And that's something actually people have seen in silicon devices over, you know, by, that are fairly long. And they have seen this effect. And that is considered to be a much more direct proof or direct evidence of spin propagation. Because, you know, the magnetoresistance, often you could argue, well, maybe it's because when you switched it, there was a magnetic field changed. And because of the magnetic fields, there's some complicated Hall effect that changed your resistance. You could argue it could be something else. But this one is believed to be a much more direct proof that as you turn up the magnetic field in this direction, not a very large magnetic field, you know, hundreds of Gauss, what people find is that the current actually oscillates, you know, goes up and down and comes back. So that we'll talk about and how you can understand that. That's a very good way to understand the dynamics of spins and how you describe it.